Matthew, the 11th chapter. When John heard in prison what the Messiah was doing, he sent word by his disciples and said to him, "Are you the one who is to come, or are we to wait for another?" Jesus answered them, "Go and tell John what you hear and see. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the poor have good news brought to them. And blessed is anyone who takes no offense at me." As they went away, Jesus began to speak to the crowds about John. "What did you go out into the wilderness to look at? A reed shaken by the wind? What then did you go out to see? Someone dressed in soft robes? Look, those who wear soft robes are in royal palaces. What then did you go out to see? A prophet? Yes, I tell you, and more than a prophet. This is the one about whom it is written, 'See, I am sending my messenger ahead of you, who will prepare your way before you.' Truly I tell you, among those born of women, no one has arisen greater than John the Baptist. Yet the least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he." The Gospel of the Lord. We can make our lives difficult if we conclude that as soon as we start something new, we should be able to get it perfect right away. And as a way to help us understand how it's more of a process in getting something under our belt, take a look at learning how to drive. I first started driving when I was about 12 or 13 years old. It's one of the advantages of being raised on a farm that has a lot of lanes and roads around the fields is that your father can put you behind the wheel of the pickup truck and tell you stay in first gear the whole time, and you can drive and get a feel for driving. Of course, as soon as he was turned away or I was out of sight, I would try to shift into second or third gear. Initially, I didn't realize you had to proceed from first to second to third. I thought you could jump from first to third, but that immediately stalled out the truck. It also was a challenge with a clutch and a shifter on the floor to get all of that coordination going at the same time. But I assumed that because I had been driving since I was 12 or 13, that when I became 16 and was able to drive on the road legally, because there were one or two occasions when we drove to our neighbor's house and we drove on the road, in first gear, of course, that once I could drive legally, that I would just get on the road and I would go. But what I found myself doing as I'm heading out Brick Church Road, which is the road that led out from my parents' farm, that in order to stay away from driving down the middle of the road, I kept overcompensating and running off the right side of the road and off the edge of the pavement and then jerking back to correct myself, which then put me back in the middle. But sooner or later, I got the feel of where I needed to be on the road and really drew the conclusion that, okay, I have this driving thing down. So my freshman year in college, and I was heading home after class, and I stopped at the stop sign in Newville, and I checked both ways and then proceeded, and I did not see the big Cadillac, that's when they made Cadillacs large back then, coming at me, which basically T-boned me and did severe damage to the car. And that's when I was reminded that maybe I don't have this driving thing down perfectly after all. So I was careful, but I let down my guard again until I was graduating from college, daydreaming as I'm driving down Route 11, didn't see the car in front of me stop, slid into it and smashed the front end of my car against the back end of the car in front of me. So it took that next sort of school of hard knocks to bring me back to myself that, okay, we still have to work on this. I had a really good long spell where driving went well, but maybe it was about 10 years ago. We were on family vacation down at the beach in North Carolina, and I was running to the grocery store by myself. The car in front of me stopped at the red light. I stopped behind the car in front of me, but I started to daydream and to pay attention to something on the seat and next in front of me, which then meant that I, by mistake, took my foot off the brake. And so my truck just gently pulled forward, and my front bumper met his back bumper. Like how I phrased that? They met each other. It was a gentle meeting. And I looked up, and I realized what had happened. And so without making a lot of movement, I put my truck in reverse and backed up a bit and then just sat there to see what was going to happen. And I could see the driver in the car in front of me. He leans over to his wife and you could almost say, did that guy behind me hit me or not? I didn't flinch. I just sat there. And when the light turned green, he proceeded on. And I breathed a sigh of relief, and I decided to turn right so that he didn't know where I was going so I could get away from it. And he, I guess, never realized that maybe we did meet there in that intersection. So driving is one of many examples of how in our lives we don't get things right the first time, but it takes work, and at times we excel, and at other times we make mistakes. Our faith lives are like that too. We don't get it perfect the first time. In fact, we hardly ever get it perfect. It's a growth process, and sometimes we excel, and other times we make mistakes. But that's okay. John the Baptist is learning about faith in this gospel text for today. John is in prison and he sends his disciples to Jesus with a question. The question is, are you the Messiah? Jesus, in essence, tells John's disciples, tell John to answer his own question by telling him what you observe. And what they see Jesus doing is that the blind are receiving their sight, and those who can't walk are able to walk. Those who have diseases are healed. The deaf can hear. Even the dead are raised, and the poor finally have hope. Tell John that's what you're encountering. Now, when we hear that list of things wrong in people's lives, our hope is that, yes, there will be healing, but we must grasp that when we hear about those things wrong in people's lives in Jesus' day, the belief at the time was that those people had done something wrong. They had sinned in some way to bring about those diseases upon themselves. So what Jesus is doing here is not only healing, he's forgiving. He's making whole both physically and spiritually. It can be a real adventure being an acolyte. It's fun to have my son serving as the acolyte today for this service. And believe it or not, acolytes aren't always excited about sitting through the sermon. Is that right? Yeah, exactly. And so the mind can start to wander and the acolyte can get bored. And I remember as a kid being an acolyte and being up front and hearing the pastor just drone on and on and on and on and on and getting bored. And this was a small rural church. And so I decided that I was going to play with the fringes on the hanging around the altar, sort of like the fringes on this here. And so I just slightly lean forward and I start playing with the fringes because it's sort of cool to do that. And if you want to come forward during the sermon, feel free to do that and pass the time. And then as the sermon continued on, I started to tie them into knots and tie them into bows, which was always an adventure. And just as I was getting very preoccupied with the fringes, I felt this ice-cold chill come down over me. I knew exactly what that was. That was my mother's teacher look. I looked up, and she was the choir director. And you have to watch out for choir directors and the way they look at you. Is that right, Dr. Horton? No, he says. And I just immediately stopped what I was doing. And really, those two moments of me getting off track and doing what I shouldn't be doing and then getting caught and held accountable for doing what was wrong, that really is how life is, isn't it? Those moments when we do something wrong, when we trip up and make a mistake, or we are intentionally harmful, or we think we're doing what's right, but really it's hurtful to other people, and we get caught in that moment and we're convicted about what we do. That moment captured what life is like for us. But here's the difference. My mother is not God. Don't tell her I said that. Because what God offers is one more piece to this. We make the mistakes, we're convicted of the mistakes, and God forgives. In mercy, God forgives us for what we have done wrong. That's the Jesus in whom John is asked to believe. The one who forgives. It is so much easier to have someone angry at us than it is to have them forgive us. Because when someone's angry with us, we can see it and hear it. I know when my wife is mad at me. You know when mom's mad at you, right, Andrew? It's clear, exactly. You know, she won't talk to me. When she walks through the house, she walks heavier than she usually walks through the house. The kitchen cabinet doors close louder than they usually close. And I know that she's mad at me. It's easier to have people mad at us because we can tell when they are mad at us. It's much more difficult to trust in forgiveness because there's nothing we can see that can confirm it. We simply have to trust the promise the person makes when they say, "I forgive you." And that's what Jesus is asking of us. Will you trust my promise that you are forgiven? Nothing will change that promise, ever. John is in prison. John is in prison because he dared to open his mouth. Last week, we talked about John the Baptist. At that point, he was out in the valley around the Jordan, he was living the dream. He had large groups of people coming up to him and listening to what he was preaching and what he was saying. He even had the religious leaders coming up to him and asking for his type of baptism just to get their bases covered for forgiveness as well. Jesus comes to John and is baptized by John, but something has happened between what we heard about John last week and the 11th chapter of Matthew this week. And what has happened is that John has criticized the king. He has challenged the king for what the king is doing to consolidate his power through marriage so that he can better control his subjects. And this speaking against that kind of behavior is what gets him arrested. The story will play out even later in the book of Matthew because John the Baptist will be beheaded for this action. And what it teaches us is that in believing and acting upon our belief, it will be countercultural to the way the rest of the world does things. If you dare speak a word of forgiveness to another person, it's an act of recreation, restoring and renewing the relationship. If you dare to affirm a person for their goodness, it's an act of building up. If you dare to engage in things that help people feel whole and complete again, it's a restoration of that person whose life has been depleted and disintegrated because of the powers around. Your actions out of faith and forgiveness are restorative, which is countercultural. And any time, speak in a way that is creative and restorative, there will immediately be a nemesis. Because the world will want to correct back the way it does things. And I think that unfortunately, by nature of how people have been raised many times in broken families, they will accept the brokenness more easily than they will accept what's whole and complete. What we say and do as people of faith is countercultural. Jesus then talks about John with those who are gathered around him. And Jesus said, "So when you went out to see John by the Jordan River, did you expect to see a king in a palace? Well, you didn't get one. He is not the one that wears the soft purple robes of a king. He's out there in the wilderness. And so John is a leader like no other leader that you know. And what did you expect from John when he's out there? And is he like a reed that when the wind blows, it goes back and forth depending on the wind? No, he has a strength about him that doesn't change depending on what is going on. And so John redefines power. He redefines leadership. He redefines power. And it's a leadership and a power that Jesus says that is as amazing as John the Baptist is, doesn't make him any better than anyone else. In fact, it's one that's rooted in humility, where he is a servant of others. We hear much talk about this language of being spiritual but not religious. I'm wondering whether we can nuance that but not religious to say I'm spiritual but I'm not into immature religion. And when I talk about immature religion, I talk about a religion that is rooted in a moralism and a judgmentalism of others. It's this kind of way of being in the world where one's life consists of accusing and resentment and negativity and circling wagons as the hurts and disappointments of life gather around us. It's this need to say, I am right and others are wrong. The need to say, I have a right to my own judgments and I will continue to use my valuable energy and time to justify what I think is right. An immature religion. So how does one get from that immature religion to a mature religion? Maturity is not determined by age. I have met people in their 20s who are wise beyond their years. And I have met people in their 70s who still display the traits of those in high school. What is it that brings about maturity? It's that humbling process that comes along when we suffer. It's that humbling process that comes along when something breaks down in our lives. It's the humbling process that comes upon us when we realize that there are so many things that we can't control and we're not in charge of everything. That humbling process that says, I'm not the center of the universe. It's a mature religion that speaks a language that builds up, that allows people to be better at something than we are, that speaks to others in a way that creates wholeness and restoration. Rooted in a faith of one who first forgives us and allows us to take the risk to be countercultural and forgive others so that they may be whole as well. Amen.